This is Audible.
Recorded Books and One Click Digital present The Wicked Boy, The Mystery of a Victorian Child Murderer by Kate Summerscale, narrated by Corey James. Prologue. In June 1930, an 11-year-old boy walked 4 miles along a dirt track in New South Wales, southeastern Australia, to report a crime. He went into a police station in a village in the bush and told the officer on duty that he had been beaten with a brush hook. The boy showed the constable the evidence. His right arm and leg were heavily grazed and bruised. His nose, his left cheek and his right eye were dark with cuts and swellings. The policeman put the child in his car and set out to investigate. The incident was reported in the local press, but to protect the identity of the child, neither his name nor that of his attacker was given. Part 1. 10 Days in July. Chapter 1. The Three of Us. Early in the morning of Monday, 8 July 1895, Robert and Nathaniel Coombs dressed themselves, collected the family's rent book from a room downstairs, and went out to the backyard. It was just after 6 a.m. and already bright and warm. Robert was 13 and Natty 12. Their father had gone to sea on Friday as chief steward on a steamship bound for New York, leaving the brothers and their mother, Emily, at home together. They lived in a small, new, yellow brick terraced house at 35 Cave Road, Plaistow, a poor but respectable working-class district in the biggest borough in the Docklands of East London. In an attempt to attract the attention of their neighbour in number 37, Robert picked up a handful of stones and threw them at the roof of the wash-house next door. At 6:15 a.m., James Robertson heard the stones clattering on the wash-house roof and came out. Mr. Robertson saw the two Coombs boys in their yard, Robert, dark-haired with blue eyes, thick eyebrows and suntanned skin, and the paler, smaller Natty. He knew them as sharp-witted lads. Robert produced a gold sovereign worth 20 shillings, or £1, and asked Mr. Robertson if he could change it for them. Mr. Robertson said that he had no silver, but offered to change the coin for 2 half-sovereigns. He fetched the 2 gold coins from his house. Robert then asked him if he would pay the rent on 35 Cave Road on their behalf, as no one would be at home when the landlady called by later that morning. Mr. Robertson agreed, and Robert gave him back 1 of the half-sovereigns, along with the family's rent book. Robert explained that he and Natty were going to watch the cricket at Lord's in North London. Mr. Robertson asked if their ma was going with them. "No," said Robert. "We had a telegram late last night from Liverpool, and she is going there. We've had a rich uncle die in Africa, and Auntie wants to see Ma." Emily Coombs sometimes travelled to the northwest of England to visit her well-to-do older sister and her mother. Mr. Robertson asked whether she had gone already. "No," said Robert. "She is going directly. She has had a faint." Or she has had a fit. When asked to recall the conversation, Mr. Robertson could not be sure. "How long ago was that?" inquired Mr. Robertson. Robert pulled a gold watch from his pocket and consulted it. "About 1.5 hours ago," he said. Mr. Robertson asked who was with their ma. Robert jerked his thumb behind him in the direction of the house. "Mrs. England," suggested Mr. Robertson. Amelia England was the Coombs' neighbour on the other side, and a close friend of Emily Coombs. "No," said Robert. He did not explain further, but added, "Perhaps Ma will see Mrs. Robertson before she goes." The boys set out for Lord's. Robert and Natty were among more than 12,000 spectators to travel to St. John's Wood that Monday to watch the Gentlemen v. Players match at Lord's, the fixture of the season at the most famous cricket ground in England. The streets near the ground were lined with lawns and villas, and on the day of a big match they were packed with people, the men in top hats, bowlers, flat caps or straw boaters, the few women in dresses with bell skirts and high necks, their hats perched on pinned-up hair and their parasols tilted at the sun. A handful of police constables in domed helmets and flared jackets moved among the crowd. The great draw that day was the legendary cricketer W.G. Grace, who at 47 was enjoying an astonishing renaissance. He had just become the first player ever to score 1,000 runs in the opening month of a season and was, according to the Illustrated London News, the most popular man in the British Isles. He would be batting for the Gentlemen, a team composed of well-born men who played for pleasure rather than profit. Their opponents, the players, were professional cricketers, most of them of working-class stock. In theory, the match pitted those who were paid to play against those who were not, though many of the Gentlemen were known to benefit handsomely from tours, gifts, and testimonials. Grace was foremost among cricket's shamateurs. Robert and Natty paid a few pennies apiece to gain admittance to the ground and made for the low roped-off stands to either side of the pitch. The more affluent spectators took their places in the tiered pavilion reserved for members of the Marylebone Cricket Club. It was a clear, hot day, tempered by soft breezes. Just after noon the bell rang, and the Gentlemen strode out from the pavilion in their whites to take their places as fielders on the huge swathe of green. The players' first batting pair emerged from their shabbier dressing room through a side entrance by the stands, which were partly covered with a white awning and backed by a belt of trees. The players had won the toss and elected to bat, as they expected to score well on a pitch hardened by 3 months of drought. But the wicket proved far more volatile than anticipated, and their batsmen performed disappointingly. By 4:40 p.m., they were all out for 231. 20 minutes later, W.G. Grace and Andrew Stoddart opened the innings for the Gentlemen. Grace lumbered onto the field in his whites, a tiny red and yellow cap on his big bearded head. It was 30 years almost to the day since he had played in his first Gentlemen v. Players match at Lord's. His partner was another cricketing hero, a graceful, spirited batsman, strikingly handsome, with a magnificent moustache. Stoddy had led the English side to victory in the last Test series in Australia, and had recently been honoured with a wax statue at Madame Tussaud's Museum in Baker Street. Despite some excellent bowling from the players, Grace and Stoddart were still at the crease 2 hours later, having notched up 137 runs between them. The stumps were pulled at 7 p.m. The two batsmen would continue their innings the next day. The Coombs boys left St. John's Wood at dusk and got back to West Ham after dark. At about 9 p.m, Robert called on Mr. Robertson. He went to the front door of number 37 while Natty waited outside the gate. "I have come back for the change," said Robert. "Is the house all right?"
"I expect so," Mr. Robertson replied. "I haven't seen anything."
He gave Robert the rent book and 3 shillings in change. The rent for each house in Cave Road was 7 shillings a week, about average for the area, but a sum that would secure only a large room in the centre of London. Once inside their house, the boys did not go to the bedrooms upstairs. Instead, they bedded down in the back parlour. Robert took the sofa and Natty the armchair. They fell asleep in their clothes. The next morning, Robert and Natty set out for Lord's again. Their mother's friend, Amelia England, who lived at number 33, saw them in the street and asked where they were going. Robert replied that they were visiting an aunt in St. John's Wood. He added that their mother was out of town, but he had just received a letter from her in which she had enclosed some money. "Very likely she will be home tomorrow evening," he said. The crowd was even bigger at Lord's on Tuesday, and the weather just as fine. For half an hour before play commenced, the fans streamed out of the trains, cabs and omnibuses, already perspiring. The Gentlemen resumed their innings at 11:30 a.m. Within 15 minutes, Stoddart was bowled out for 71, but Grace kept going. As he neared his 100, the crowd grew excited,
and when he made the century, a storm of applause was raised by the spectators and the players alike. It was Grace's 7th century of the season in a first-class game. His achievement that morning was all the greater because the bowling was exceptional. At 1:40 p.m., Grace's innings ended with a catch at the wicket. 8 of his 10 teammates had also been dismissed by the time they broke for lunch at 2. Despite Grace's century, the gentleman had only 252 runs for 9 wickets. The Coombs brothers had brought provisions to the match. They ate their food in the shade of a shed in the grounds. When play continued after lunch, the gentlemen were all out in 10 minutes, having scored only 7 more runs. The players came on for a second innings, and by the time the stumps were pulled at 7 p.m, they had scored 269 runs and lost just 6 wickets. They were well ahead. Robert and Natty made their way back again to East London, but instead of heading straight home, they made for the new Theatre Royal in Stratford, 2 miles northwest of Cave Road. The play they watched that evening, Light Ahead, told the story of a man framed for murder by a shipyard employee who had turned forger, bigamist, and killer. The theatrical newspaper, The Era, observed that the show would appeal to the pit and the gallery, a working-class audience such as that found in Stratford, but pronounced it a straggling, uneven piece that proceeds on its course for a considerable time with no light ahead whatever as to how it is to turn and in what manner it will end. The highlights of the production were a specially constructed lifeboat, which was hoisted onto the stage for the finale, a winning and womanly heroine, and an audacious villain whose gleeful malignancy excited the admiration even of the Era's critic. In the back parlour of 35 Cave Road, where Robert and Natty again slept that night, Robert kept his collection of penny dreadfuls, or penny bloods. These were melodramatic adventures in the same vein as Light Ahead, published weekly as magazines. They were set all over the world, on the high seas, in the crime-ridden streets of London and New York, the jungles of Africa, on the plains of the Wild West, and the islands of the Far East. Some took place in a fantastical future of electrical stagecoaches and flying machines, others in a blood-soaked past of noble crusaders and haunted knights. Among Robert's most recent purchases was Jack Wright and the Fortune Hunters of the Red Sea, part of an American series loosely inspired by the novels of Jules Verne. Jack is an orphan inventor, a manly-looking boy with a fine athletic figure, who travels the globe in ingenious vessels of his own making, fighting rogues and tracking down treasure. In his Red Sea adventure, published in the first week of July, Jack sails across the Atlantic from America to Africa. His submarine, the Meteor, is a slender pod of plate glass and steel, its compact cabins washed with silvery light, flashing with instruments, gleaming with levers, wires, and electromagnets. After much danger and daring do, storms of rain and sand, the rescue of a drowning maiden, fights with Arab pearl divers and Yankee bank robbers, he reaches his quarry, a cache of treasure at the bottom of the Red Sea, guarded by a 20-foot-long winged lizard. To vanquish the dragon and lay claim to the loot, Jack dons a submarine suit and dives through a blood-red sea to the creature's cave. Once he is inside the grotto, a hunk of coral rolls over the entrance. He was entombed, alive! The giant lizard springs at Jack and sinks its double row of curved black teeth into the boy's flesh. Jack wriggles free, aims his pistol and shoots, but the creature only briefly recoils. The beast was floating high over his head near the ceiling, squirming its long, slender body like a snake, and glaring down at him with its enormous, fiery eyes. It darts towards him again, its huge red mouth gaping. "If it reaches me," thinks Jack, "I have no doubt that it will tear me to pieces, goaded as it is to the height of its fury." When the creature surges forward and curls its body around his, Jack drops his pistol and draws a dagger. Plunging it into the beast's head, he buried the blade up to the hilt, and a convulsive throw of pain seemed to dart through it, and it sank to the ground. The monster lets go of Jack as it falls. Upon seeing the repulsive object stretched out dead in front of him, the boy breathes a sigh of relief and rises to his feet. "Cruel, savage, spiteful," he mutters. "I never before encountered a beast so fearless and bloodthirsty." The rubies and sapphires on the seabed are now his for the taking. Jack gathers them up and digs his way out of the cave to freedom.
On Wednesday, another fiercely hot day, Robert took a key from the top of the clock on the mantelpiece in the back parlour and went upstairs with his brother. He unlocked the door to his mother's room at the front of the house, and both boys went in to raise the window blinds, which had been down since Sunday night. The boys' funds were running low, and neither of them had a job. Natty was playing truant from Cave Road School, a hulking three-story block for 1,570 students built opposite their house the previous summer. Robert had left the school in May, having completed his eighth and last year of state-funded education. He had then found work in a shipyard by the docks, but after a fortnight had jacked it in. The brothers decided to head for the docks now to look for a man called John Fox, who a few years earlier had been an assistant steward to their father. Fox made his home on the ships lying at anchor. He slept in the galleys and ran errands for the officers and crew. Robert thought that he might help them to raise some money. The horse-drawn trams and buses to the nearest dock gate ran southwest along the Barking Road, the thoroughfare at the end of Robert and Natty's street. The route was busy with shops, grocers, butchers, fried fish sellers, tailors, hatters, post offices, a bicycle seller, a marine supplier, a cheesemonger, chemists, coal merchants, confectioners, bakers. The closest church was just past the tobacconist at 500 Barking Road, the Coombs family's doctor at number 480, the police station at 386. At number 110 was a new public hall and free library, which in February had become the first building in West Ham to be equipped with electricity. 2 miles down the Barking Road, the boys passed the crowded lanes of Canning Town, a darker, more desperate district than their own. The casual labourers from these rickety terraces pressed at the dock gates each morning, hungry for work. Over the previous 2 decades, the docks, factories and railways had drawn hordes of people to West Ham, swelling the population from 12,000 in 1870 to close to 200,000 by 1895. London over the border, as it was known, was the industrial hub of the empire and a new metropolis of the poor. This was both the city and the city's shadow, its furthest dirty reach. The streets by the Thames teemed with British and Irish labourers and with sailors from all over the world, Malays, Lascars, Swedes, Chinamen. "There is no seaport in the country," said the novelist Walter Besant, "which is so charged with the atmosphere of ocean and the suggestion of things far off." The noise was tremendous. The clatter of trains and trams, the blasts of ship horns, the grinding of chains, the whine of winches, the thunder and crash of the machines at the Thames Ironworks Shipbuilding Company, where Robert had briefly worked in June. Robert and Natty were admitted to the Royal Victoria Dock through a giant gate by the hydraulic coal cranes. John Fox was usually to be found on one of the vessels owned by the National Line, for which the boy's father worked, so Robert and Natty went first to the National Steamer Spain. The ship stank of animal flesh, urine and excrement, the main trade of the National Line vessels being the carriage of live cattle from New York to London. Robert asked an officer on the Spain whether Fox was on board.
"I don't know," said Charles Pearson, chief officer of the National Steamship Queen. "Go and look. Whose boy are you?"
Robert replied that he was Mr. Coombs's son. Pearson knew the older Robert Coombs, having sailed with him on the SS Holland out of Liverpool. He asked Robert who wanted Fox.
"The man at the gate," said Robert.
Pearson turned to Natty.
"I suppose you are one of Mr. Coombs's boys, too?"
Natty said that he was. The brothers went aft in search of Fox. As they could not find him, they decided to try the SS America, the only other National Line vessel then moored in London. The America was in the Royal Albert Dock, which lay immediately east of the Royal Victoria, but the scale of the docks was such, 3 miles from end to end, that it took the boys more than 2 hours to tramp round one and then the other, past the metal sheds and the pungent tobacco warehouses and the skeletal cranes, round the dockers loading and unloading the cargoes. The river alongside was low and sluggish, glittering in the sun. Many noxious industries that were banned from the centre of London had established themselves on this stretch of the Thames, and a haze of coal dust and smoke hung over the docks. The sour, urinous scent of the Bryant and May matchworks mingled with the musty caramel of the Tate and the Lyle sugar refineries, with the smells of rotting cow carcasses in the John Knight soap factory, of simmering oranges and strawberries in James Keeler's marmalade and jam works, of boiling bones and offal in Odom's chemical manure works, of bird droppings at the guano works, and with the acrid, stinging chemical vapours of the factories making rubber, caustic soda, sulfuric acid, telegraph wire, dyes, creosote, disinfectant, cables, explosives, poisons, and varnish. For weeks there had been no rain to rinse the air. The boys could not find Fox on the America, so they went back to the Victoria dock to try the Spain again. This time, Natty waited outside the gate while Robert approached the dock constable on duty.
"I want to go to the National Line steamer lying just alongside there to see John Fox," Robert told William Gradley. "I have an important message to deliver to him, having come from Plaistow."
Gradley let him through.
"I shall not be long," said Robert.
At last Robert found Fox on the Spain. A short man of 45, with a thin moustache and a straggly beard, Fox was wearing a dark threadbare suit and a peaked sailor's cap. Robert asked him to come to stay with them in Cave Road. Their mother had gone suddenly to Liverpool to visit her family, he said, and had left word that she wanted Fox to look after the boys in the house. Robert told Fox that when Emily Coombs returned, she would pay him 0.5 crown for each day that he spent at Cave Road. 0.5 crown was 2 and 6, an eighth of a pound, a decent daily rate for unskilled work. Fox agreed to come. The pair crossed the bridge out of the docks.
"Good night, Bradley," called
Fox to Gradley as they went out through the dock gate. Though he had known the dock constable for 6 years, Fox still hadn't learnt his name. They joined Natty and made the journey back to Plaistow. In the back parlour of 35 Cave Road, Robert reached behind the door and lifted down a dark grey tweed suit belonging to his father.
"Here you are, John," he said. "Here's a pair of father's trousers for you. They don't fit him."
Fox went to the kitchen behind the parlour to put on the suit. He left his old clothes on a stool by the copper cauldron that heated the household's water. Robert told Fox that his mother had suggested that they pawn the family's watches to raise some money until her return. He asked whether Fox would pledge them on their behalf. Pawnbrokers would not take pledges from children.
"I will try if I can," said Fox.
The boys handed him their watches, Robert's gold and Natty's silver, and the three went out to Limehouse. They travelled 3 miles west, crossing the iron bridge over the black waters of Bow Creek, the mouth of the River Lee, and the repository of West Ham's untreated sewage. Limehouse was a Thameside neighbourhood in the older part of East London, frequented by sailors. Robert and Natty had lived here until they were 9 and 8 years old, latterly in a large house in 3 Colt Street that their grandparents had owned. In the past few years the district had grown even noisier and more louche. It was a hive of brothels, pubs, Chinese laundries and opium dens. John Fox visited 2 pawnbrokers, one for each watch. At George
Fish's shop in the Commercial Road, the boys waited outside while Fox went in to pledge the American-made gold-plated watch. The manager, William White, had difficulty with the catch, but once Fox had shown him how to open it, he offered a 10-shilling loan against the watch's value. He issued a square pasteboard ticket bearing a description of the pawned item, attached a duplicate to the watch, and entered in his ledger the name and address that Fox gave him, Robert Coombs, 35 Cave Road. He did not question Fox's identity. This was a transient part of London, where most customers were strangers, and in any case it was common practice for hired moppets to pawn goods on behalf of respectable people who did not wish to advertise their financial troubles. White deducted the halfpenny ticket fee from the loan and gave Fox the remainder. The watch could be redeemed by returning the money with 25% interest within the next 3 months. A few doors along at Ashbridge & Co., Fox tried to get 12 shillings for the silver watch, but accepted 10. Fox handed Robert the pawn tickets and the proceeds, just under 20 shillings or £1.
"Let us share it between the three of us now," said Robert.
Robert and Natty had missed the final day of the Gentlemen v. Players fixture at Lord's. The evening papers carried reports of the match. The Players had won by a slender 32 runs, as well as the results of the latest games in the 19th Wimbledon Lawn Tennis Championships, and the news that the polling dates for a general election had been set. The very unpopular Liberal Prime Minister, the Earl of Rosebery, had resigned in June, and Parliament had since been dissolved. The polling for a new government would take place over 3 weeks, starting on 13 July. The date set for the voters of West Ham South and West Ham North to elect their members of Parliament was the next Monday, 15 July. A fire broke out that evening at William Hoskins' hairdressing shop at 264 Barking Road. The flames ripped through the walls of the building and pulled in the roof with a terrific crash. A fire truck reached the scene quickly, but because of the drought, the water supplies in the district were very low, and the local turncock ran about frantically for half an hour before he was able to obtain a trickle of water from a hydrant. The fireman screwed a hose to the spout and trained it on the building. A large crowd gathered to watch them fight the blaze. Back at Cave Road, Robert fetched a blanket from the back bedroom upstairs, and he, Fox and Natty went to bed in the back parlour. Fox lay on the floor, as he had done before when staying overnight. Robert asked Fox if he knew the way to India. Fox said that he did. In the Jack Wright stories, the young hero takes two comrades on his adventures around the world, Fritz Schneider, a short Dutchman, and Timothy Topstay, a wooden-legged, glass-eyed, tobacco-chewing, whiskery old sailor who has served on merchant ships with Jack's father. John Fox, the former shipmate of Robert and Natty's father, was now hunkered down with the boys in the back parlour, like Tim Topstay, hunkered down with Jack and Fritz in the sealed cabin of Jack's electrical submarine. Chapter 2. All I Know Is That We Are Rich. Flush with their pawn shop funds, Robert, Natty and John Fox walked the next morning to William Richardson's coffee house at the junction of Cave Road and the Barking Road. The boys were carrying bamboo fishing rods, having decided to take a trip to the seaside after breakfast. Fox was wearing his new suit. All three entered the coffee house, but Natty stopped in the lobby, and despite Robert's entreaties, refused to come any further. Mr. Richardson's place was one of dozens of coffee shops in West Ham, serving coffee and tea, slices of bread and butter, eggs, bacon, chops and steaks. The windows of a coffee shop, described by Punch magazine as the restaurant of poor respectability, were usually decorated with gold lettering, while the interior gleamed with polished wood and brass. The customers, labourers, hansom cab drivers, the lower grade of clerk, sat on benches in wooden stalls where they could peruse the day's papers as they dined. Mr. Richards greeted Robert and Fox, remarking that Fox was looking smart. Fox smiled. He and Robert ordered and ate their breakfast, and then Robert paid the bill with a shilling, 12 pence or 1/20 of a pound, and offered the coffee housekeeper a chunk of cake tobacco. Mr. Richard said he did not smoke, but Robert left the tobacco on the table anyway. He and Fox collected Natty from the lobby, crossed the road to a fruiterer's, and set out on their excursion to Southend-on-Sea. The nearest seaside town to London, Southend, lay at the mouth of the Thames, 40 miles east of West Ham. In the 18th century, the highwayman and penny dreadful hero, Dick Turpin, had smuggled goods to Plaistow from Southend. The town was now a favourite destination for the London working classes. They steamed down to the coast by train or boat on Sunday school excursions, works outings and bank holiday beanos. A record 35,000 people had travelled by rail to Southend for the Whit Bank holiday in June. The train from central London, which cost 2 and 6 pence for the round trip, called at Plaistow and West Ham stations, while the London Bell steamship sailed from Woolwich by the Victoria and Albert docks at 10:15 each morning. John Fox, Robert and Natty reached Southend at about noon. The sun was hot and the sky blue. They walked through the Pier Hill Fairground, which boasted a steam-powered razzle-dazzle, an aerial platform that tilted as it turned, a merry-go-round, swing boats, coconut shies, and stalls selling shrimps, oysters and cockles. The famous Iron Pier, completed 5 years earlier, stretched a mile and a half out to sea. Just inside its stuccoed entrance was the pavilion at which little Elsie, the skirt dancer, would twirl her silk robes at that evening's show, and an electric train that carried visitors to the pier head. At low tide, a vast bed of mud stretched beneath the promenade decking. At high tide, the water lapped at the pier's pillars, and yachts danced close by on the waves. The boys cast their fishing lines into the sea. Robert told Fox they would all three of them soon sail away to some place. "What place?" asked Fox. "Some island," said Robert. Almost exactly 12 months earlier, Robert had visited Southend to see the most notorious murderer of recent years. Robert was a pupil at Stock Street School in Plaistow when he read of the killing of Florence Dennis, a 23-year-old dressmaker whose body had been found pressed into the mud by a brook just outside Southend on 24 June 1894. She had been shot through the head and had fallen to the ground, still clasping her straw hat in one hand. The post-mortem revealed that she was 8 months pregnant. James Canham Reed, a 37-year-old employee of the Royal Albert Dock, was immediately identified as the chief suspect. He had been seen twice with Florence and Southend that weekend. Reed, who had lived in East London for nearly 20 years, was known around the docks as a responsible and educated family man. He earned more than £150 a year as a cashier and was entrusted with paying out some £2,000 a day to the Albert Docks labourers and to the lightermen who ferried goods by barge from the ships to the quays. A slim, fastidious figure with a dark moustache, he was fond of reading, and had set up a library when he worked in the Victoria Dock. He lived with his wife and 8 children in Jamaica Street, Stepney, just west of Limehouse. On the day that Florence Dennis's body was discovered, Reed went on the run, taking with him more than £100 from his office at the dock. Crowds gathered outside his house in Jamaica Street and hollered abuse at his family. The local and national papers reported avidly on the hunt for the fugitive. After a fortnight, the police tracked Reed down to a village southwest of London, living under a false name with yet another woman. He had been leading a triple life, and it seemed that he had killed Florence Dennis because she had threatened to expose him, to collapse the walls between his several selves. The lower-middle-class Lothario, as the Times described him, was taken by train to Southend to be arraigned. The news of Reed's arrest spread fast. By the time he and his police guards reached Southend in the evening of 7 July, Scores of people were waiting beside the railway. They ran after the cab that drove Reed to the police station.
When Robert learned of Reed's arrest, he slipped away from his house and set off for Southend. He had 2 shillings for the train fare, which was enough to take him only as far as Grays, a village on the Thames 20 miles east of London. He walked the remaining 20 miles to Southend, stopping to catch some sleep under a hedge by the roadside. At 11 a.m. on Monday, 9 July, Reed appeared before a magistrate in the courthouse by the police station, just off the main road between Southend Railway Station and the pier. Hundreds of people pressed into the court or stood outside looking up at the windows, hooting and whistling. Reed wore a light tweed suit and a white straw hat. He affected a nonchalant air, approaching the dock with a quick and elastic step, and then calmly denying the murder charge. The magistrate remanded him for trial at Chelmsford, Essex. When Reed was tried for murder in November, he again displayed uncanny control of his emotions. His command of himself was simply marvellous, said the Pall Mall Gazette. He continued to protest his innocence, and his brother Harry provided an alibi, but the circumstantial evidence against him was very strong. James Canham Reed was found guilty of murder on 15 November. He walked jauntily out of the courthouse, stopping to shake hands with people who had assembled outside, and stepped gaily up the steps of the prison van. Few doubted Reed's guilt, observed the Evening News, but his nerve, his cool yet daring demeanour, and his keen and bright intelligence won the admiration of many. The crowd seemed to feel an inclination to cheer him. Harry Reed followed him out of the court. He was obviously shaken, said the paper, but behaved with wonderful fortitude, showing of what stuff these 2 remarkable brothers are made. A peculiar heroism had attached itself to the pair. On 4 December 1894, James Canham Reed was hanged. In his will, he left nothing to his wife or children, but instead bequeathed everything to the brother who had tried to protect him. Harry drowned in the Regent's Canal in East London the next year, apparently in a drunken accident. James Canham Reed was refined, calculating, ruthless, with a compulsion to possess and control women, even if it meant killing them. In his smooth composure, he resembled both the villains and the heroes in the penny dreadfuls that Robert liked to read. The killer in The Bogus Broker's Right Bower, a New York crime story in Robert's collection, had a coolness somewhat remarkable even in a murderer. The detective on his track is the coolest and best prepared ferret, a fox with nerves of steel. Mora, the villainous, is the chilliest of all. Everything depends on coolness and holding on with bulldog tenacity, she says. I am still Mora, the cool. Mora acts with icy precision, even as her gypsy blood boils. Her coolness is a capacity, the ability to have 2 faces and to hide 1 from the world. In the 5 days after their trip to Southend, the Coombs brothers amused themselves by playing cricket with John Fox in the backyard and cards at the parlour table. They visited the Balham Street Recreation Ground, a park near their house that had opened the previous summer. It contained a pond on which children could sail toy boats, a raised stand on which a brass band performed each week, lawns and ornamental flower gardens. The boys of Plaistow also played in the streets, as they had before the park opened, sometimes in small gangs known as cliques. Robert would take his bat out for a game of cricket, wedging a stump between the stones on the pavement opposite the house. Football was popular with the local boys, as were games of knocking down ginger, rapping on people's doors and then running away, pitch and toss, a gambling game, leapfrog and robbers and thieves. Natty continued to skip school. Though Plaistow was a crowded working-class suburb, it was bordered by fields and marshland. Just over the wall at the end of the Coombs family's yard was a large market garden. From the front of the house on a clear day,
you could see across the marshes and the river to the hills of Kent. The German writer, H. A. Volkers, had strolled up to the neighbourhood from the docks one summer Sunday in 1886, approaching through the fields directly south of Cave Road.
"The country was all level, with ditches of water running through," he reported, "and on each side was the smooth roads, fields containing fine grass, sleek, fat cows, calves, and horses feeding on them, acres of land with onions, young turnips, lettuce, rhubarb, etc."
In Plaistow, Volkers passed a crowd listening to members of the peculiar people sect, singing, "Jerusalem, my happy home," and another group following a Salvation Army drum and flute band down the street. Many middle-class visitors to West Ham recoiled at the repeating streets, the level, dingy, narrow vistas, the shabby men and women herding themselves into trams like cattle. But on this sunny afternoon, the German traveller was struck by the rosy cheeks of the children, and the abundance of carnations, roses and geraniums filling the pots on the window sills of the neat little houses. Fox and the boys occasionally ate out, but they usually dined off food prepared by Robert. As the eldest son in a family without daughters, Robert had learned to be handy about the house. He was not only accustomed to boys' jobs, fetching coal, laying the fire, emptying the privy in the yard, but also to washing, cooking, and cleaning. He took deliveries from the tradesmen who called at 35 Cave Road, asking them to leave the usual quantities, and paying them for the goods. He baked sausage rolls and jam tarts with a batch of flour that his mother had ordered. He washed his clothes and hung them to dry on a line over the fireplace. The ground floor of 35 Cave Road was supplied with gas and running water, and the kitchen was equipped with a coal-powered iron range. In their parents' absence, Robert and Natty were responsible for the family's cats and an American mockingbird named Bill. Each evening, Fox smoked his pipe, and Robert smoked cigarettes. There was no age restriction on who could purchase tobacco, despite public concern about the number of boy smokers, and it was possible to buy a box of 5 fags for a penny. Rolling tobacco was cheaper still. The trio continued to use the back parlour as their bedroom, though on the night after their trip to Southend, Robert suggested to Fox that he sleep in the back room upstairs. Robert and Natty went up with him, and while Fox was preparing the bed, Robert unlocked the door to their mother's bedroom and went in for a couple of minutes. Natty waited outside. The boys then went down to their usual berths in the back parlour. Robert set about devising fresh money-raising schemes. On Saturday he wrote a letter for Fox to take to the National Line officers at the Albert Dock. Fox delivered the letter to John Hewson, the company's chief cashier, at about noon. Hewson, who was 64, lived in the relatively well-to-do West Ham district of Forest Gate, north of Plaistow. He was responsible for paying Robert's father's wages, and was able to hand out cash advances. A distinguished-looking man with a long nose and a white beard, Hewson was known to be tender-hearted. When an overladen National Line vessel disappeared on its way from New York to London in 1889, with 74 seamen aboard, the distraught wives of the missing men turned up at the company offices in the city, pleading for an advance on their husbands' wages. They were treated harshly by everyone except Hewson. "He was kind and said he was sorry for us," one woman told an MP inquiring into the case. "He was trouble for us. The rest were angry with us for coming to the office." In his office at the Albert Dock, Hewson read Robert's letter. "Dear Sir," it ran, "will you please advance the sum of £4, as my mother is very ill with heart disease and will have to pay a heavy doctor's bill. Will you please bring it yourself or give it to John Fox? I remain yours truly, R. Coombs." Despite his good nature, Hewson was suspicious. Robert had once before obtained money from him under false pretences. He handed the letter back to Fox, saying he would not believe it unless he were provided with a doctor's certificate. Fox pocketed the letter and went back to Cave Road with the news. On learning that this plan had failed, Robert asked Fox to pawn his mandolin. Robert was as fond of playing music as he was of reading, and the mandolin was a treasured possession. Between 8 and 9 o'clock in the evening, Fox took the instrument to another pawnbroker, this one much closer to home. Richard Bourne's shop, opposite the railway station on Plaistow High Street. When the broker observed that there was no key to fasten the mandolin's case, Fox said that the case would close securely without being locked. Bourne advanced him 5 shillings. This time, Fox gave the name Nathaniel Coombs, along with the address 35 Cave Road. The boys and Fox spent much of Sunday in the backyard. The weather had cooled off a little, but was still bright and dry, with more than 9 hours of sunshine. Fox, wearing Mr. Coombs's jacket, trousers and waistcoat, played his harmonica, breaking off to chat with James Robertson of No. 37 over the garden fence. Robert and Natty shot at each other with toy bows and arrows. They grew so noisy that Fox warned them that if they didn't pipe down, he would report them to their mother when she got back. Cowboy and Indian games were popular among English boys. Robert's Penny Dreadful collection included a reprint of an American dime novel about Buffalo Bill, as the famous bison hunter and showman William F. Cody was known. For 6 months in 1892, when Robert was 10, Cody had staged a Wild West extravaganza at Earl's Court in London, with a herd of horses and a troop of Red Indians. According to the stories, the young Buffalo Billy was marked out by pluck, endurance, nerve, a restless urge for adventure. He was loyal and honourable. He tended to his wounded comrades, gave his widowed mother the money he earned by driving cattle, but could be ruthless in a crisis. On one occasion, he got into a fight with a boy who had set him up for a humiliating whipping at school. Since the bigger boy was getting the better of him, Billy drew a pocket knife, opened the blade with his teeth, drove it into his enemy's side, and left him for dead. Over the weekend, the election campaigning in West Ham South gathered pace. The incumbent Member of Parliament, James Keir Hardie of the Independent Labour Party, led a parade through the streets on Saturday with marching bands and banners. At an evening meeting in the public hall at Barking Road, the socialist playwright George Bernard Shaw gave a speech in support of Keir Hardie, and an organ belted out rousing tunes. "Glory, glory, hallelujah," the people sang. "Keir Hardie's marching on." The constituency had recently acquired a reputation for radicalism. In a famous strike of 1889, the dockers of West Ham had succeeded in securing a minimum rate of 6p an hour, and when Keir Hardie was elected MP in 1892, West Ham South had become the first independent Labour seat in the country. A long-haired, wild-eyed Scottish miner, Hardie told his followers that he would use the state to lift the weary load which is crushing the heart and life and beauty and joy out of the common people. He was able, according to a supporter, to make the workers feel that there is sunshine somewhere if they could but come at it. But a rise in unemployment in 1894 had been worsened by a harsh winter of fogs, ice and snow, when parts of the Thames froze over and many of the yards were forced to close. In 1895, some 10,000 men in West Ham were without work, and the district was poorer than ever. Many blamed Lord Rosebery's Liberal government, which Keir Hardie's party had supported, for failing to relieve the people's plight. There were more radical elements in West Ham even than Keir Hardie. Earlier in July, a local anarchist called Edward Leggett had been prosecuted for travelling second class on the railway while carrying a third-class ticket. "I only recognise one class," proclaimed Leggett, "namely the working class, who produce all the wealth of the world, and are therefore the only useful class, and the only class entitled to ride." Given the choice of a fine or 14 days in prison, Leggett said, "I'll do the 14 days. Long live anarchy, and to hell with the government." Some anarchists took more lethal action. In 1894, an activist had accidentally blown himself up while trying to bomb the Greenwich Observatory across the river from West Ham. At 8 a.m. on Monday, 15 July, the polls opened in the twin constituencies of West Ham South and West Ham North, and the men of the borough began to turn out to elect their MP. An Act of 1884 had extended the vote to all men who lived in a property worth £10. A donkey traipsed up and down Balham Street bearing placards that urged voters to support Major George Baines, the Tory candidate, while the bricklayer brandished a hodden shovel adorned with portraits of Keir Hardie. The right-wing Evening News, encouraging its readers to drive the Liberals and Radicals out of London, appealed directly to the labourers of Canning Town. "West Ham workers, attention! The late Liberal government refused to place any of the recent naval contracts at the Thames Ironworks, Canning Town, although there was exceptional distress there through slack trade." The local publicans also supported the Conservatives, who had promised not to interfere with the licensing laws. Some of the owners of the boozing shops near the docks were charging a penny for 3 shots of whisky and a threepenny cigar, then bundling their customers into vehicles provided by the Tories to ferry voters to the polling stations. While Natty went to play in Balham Street Park, Robert made his way to the Albert Dock to try to persuade John Hewson to give him some money. He took with him an old doctor's certificate, from which he had torn off the date in the top corner, 20 March 1895, in the hope that Hewson would accept it as new. The sharper villains in Robert's penny dreadfuls were adept at forging and altering documents. "I am an extra good penman, you know," boasts the Irish master criminal Captain Murphy in Robert's novelette, Joe Phoenix's Unknown, "and by means of a little dexterous use of chemicals, it will be easy for me to take out the original numbers of the bonds or shares and put in others." Robert placed the certificate on Hewson's desk and waited as he read it. "I certify that Mrs. Emily Coombs of 35 Cave Road is under my care," read Hewson. "She is suffering from an internal complaint and still remains in a very weak state. J.J. Griffin, M.D. Hewson told Robert that he would come later to Cave Road to visit Mrs. Coombs. "Will you bring the money with you?" asked Robert. "I'll see," said Hewson. He put the letter in his file. Robert again looked in on his mother's room that day, then locked the door and gave Natty the key. "Keep the key," he said. Natty put the key in the back parlour. Robert told Natty that he was going to write a letter to their father. He sat at the table with a blotting pad, paper, pen and ink, and proceeded to do so. "Dear Pa," Robert wrote, "I am very sorry to inform you that me Ma has hurt her hands. You know that sore on her finger? It has spread out all over her hands and is unable to write to you. Just before I had written in this letter, a bill from Mr. Greenaway has come, and Ma had to pay it. Mr. Griffin also had charged a heavy doctor's bill. Ma said, 'Will you please send her home a dollar or two? We are all very well, and Ma's hand improving. Ma was offered £4 for Bill the Mockingbird. I enclose the bill, and hoping you are very well, I remain your loving son, R. Coombs.'" Robert folded the letter and put it in an envelope with a £1, 8 shilling and 6 pence bill from the Limehouse tailor, Isaac Greenaway and Sons. The tailor's bill, dated 10 July, detailed the costs of repairing a jacket, fitting the same jacket with a fur collar, and purchasing a waistcoat and a pair of fancy Scotch grey trousers. Robert also wrote a letter to the Evening News, which had more readers than any other evening paper in London. Its edition of 15 November 1894, which carried the first reports of James Canham Reed's conviction for murder, had sold close to 400,000 copies, a world record, the paper claimed. The Evening News was pitched at the respectable and conservative working classes who populated the Plaistow end of West Ham South, while poorer, more dissident types prevailed in Canning Town and the other riverside districts. "Sir," wrote Robert to the editor, "will you please be kind enough to place my advertisement in the Evening News for 1 week? I send the money in stamps." The newspaper's classified section promised that an advertisement could be placed for the price of a telegram. That is, sixpence for 12 words and half a penny for each additional word. Robert's notice read, "Wanted, £30 for 6 months. Will pay £6 a month by instalments. Write to R.C., 35 Cave Road, Barking Road, Plaistow, E."
Robert had modelled the wording on similar ads that had appeared in the paper's columns.
£2 wanted privately for 2 months at 10% interest, announced F. of Kensington on 4 July. Robert was asking for a bigger loan and a longer period to pay it back, and in return was offering a generous interest rate of 20%. He addressed the letter to the newspaper's offices near Fleet Street. At about 6 o'clock in the evening of 15 July, Robert and Natty's aunt, Emily, called round to see her sister-in-law. She had found no one at home when she had tried the house the previous week. Emily was a dark-haired woman of 38, whose husband, Nathaniel, was a younger brother of Robert and Natty's father. He worked as a greengrocer, as his father had before him, but in the depression of the early 1890s was struggling to make ends meet. The couple lived with their 17-year-old daughter a mile northeast of Cave Road, in another of the terraces that had been built on the marshland in the past 2 decades, as regular as if they had been punched out on a production line. Emily brought with her a friend called Mary Jane Burridge, who was also a friend of her sister-in-law. Mrs. Burridge, a thick-set woman of 45, was married to the chief butcher on the SS Ionic, a White Star liner that ferried sheep to England from New Zealand. Like Robert and Natty's father, George Burridge had sailed with the national ships out of the Liverpool docks until moving to West Ham with his family in the 1880s to work on vessels based in East London. When Aunt Emily knocked at 35 Cave Road, John Fox came to the door and opened it a few inches. Emily had never seen Fox before. She noticed that he was wearing her brother-in-law's best church-going suit, which she had herself brushed and put away after its purchase 6 weeks earlier. She nudged her foot across the threshold and asked for Mrs. Coombs. Fox told her that she was not in. He kept the door almost closed, as if to stop Emily seeing into the house. "Where is she?" asked Emily. "She is out," replied Fox. Emily pressed him. "I am her sister-in-law, and I want to know where she has gone to." Fox replied that Mrs. Coombs had gone to her sister's in Liverpool for a holiday. Emily observed that it was funny that her sister-in-law had not mentioned this to her, at which Fox pushed the door shut. The two women were turning away to leave when they saw Robert and Natty running towards them. The boys had been playing in the park. Natty stopped at the gate, but Robert came forward to greet his aunt. Emily asked him where his ma was. "She has gone to Liverpool, auntie," he replied. "A rich aunt has died and left us a lot of money, and all that I know is that we are rich." Then Robert started back towards the recreation ground. Aunt Emily remarked to Mrs. Burridge that it was unkind of her sister-in-law to go away without mentioning it to her. Robert reappeared with some other boys and called to Natty, who ran after him. Aunt Emily and Mrs. Burridge gave up and made their way home. That evening, a girl from Cave Road called on Aunt Emily at her house in Berlin Road, East Ham. The girl said that she had been sent by her mother, who had noticed an unpleasant smell at number 35, and did not think that all was right. There was no running water when Robert and Natty got home from the park. At 5 p.m, the East London Water Company had shut off West Ham's supply without warning. The reserves were so low that the company had decided to open its taps for only 2.5 hours a day. East London slowly became suffused with the smell of unflushed drains. As the polling deadline of 8 p.m. approached, boisterous crowds assembled near the public hall at the southern end of the Barking Road, hooting and cheering the last men to cast their votes for West Ham South's MP. In the course of the evening, the crowd moved north to Stratford to hear the borough's results, along roads lit by gas lamps, past the glowing lanterns of the pubs and the wild flares of the oil lamps on the costermonger stalls. By 11 p.m., About 20,000 people had congregated outside the ornate town hall on Stratford Broadway, bringing the traffic to a standstill. When a tram tried to drive through, the crowd scattered, some people running into the front line of constables who had been sent to keep order. The policemen retaliated with punches, while the mounted patrols rode their horses into the mass of men and women. Rather than fight back, the residents of West Ham launched into a rendition of Rule Britannia, singing out that Britons never, never, never shall be slaves. At midnight, the candidates for West Ham South and West Ham North appeared on the balcony of the town hall for the reading of the results. It was announced that the Tory contender for West Ham South, Major Baines, had secured 4,750 votes to Labour's 3,975. He had beaten Keir Hardie, the Dockers' champion. The Liberal incumbent for West Ham North had also been ousted from his seat by the Conservative challenger. Keir Hardie made his way back to Canning Town to thank his supporters, thousands of whom had gathered outside the Labour Party's central committee room in the Barking Road. "Tomorrow," he told them, "when the news reaches 100,000 workmen's homes, there will be a feeling as if something has gone out of their lives." Yet he urged his supporters not to lose heart. They would win through one day. "Good night, lads," he said. Many of the men in the street broke down in tears. The local publicans celebrated the Tory win with a triumphant display of fireworks and coloured lights. Chapter 3. I Will Tell You the Truth. As the milkman left his delivery on the doorstep of 35 Cave Road early in the morning of Wednesday, 17 July, he noticed a particularly horrid smell emanating from the building. He informed the neighbours, who again sent word to the boy's aunt in Boleyn Road. Aunt Emily turned up at 35 Cave Road at 9 a.m. No one answered when she knocked, so she collected Mary Jane Burridge from her home in New City Road on the other side of the Barking Road, and at 10 a.m. they once more tried Emily Coombs's front door. Since there was still no reply, the two women decided to call on Robert and Natty's grandmother in Bow, west of Plaistow, to see if she knew what was going on. The 74-year-old Mary Coombs lived on the edge of Bow Cemetery, in a two-up, two-down terraced house, almost identical to the homes of her elder sons and